Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hands. A divinely appointed Imam, nurtured and educated by a divinely appointed Imam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, the ninth divinely appointed Imam, of course, is the Imam who was selected divinely by the previous Imam, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. Now, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was contemporary with the Abbasid caliphs, and we find that the Abbasid caliphs had this immoral and quite decadent way of living. Now, as far as their decadence is concerned, we find that the amount of moral and societal, governmental, financial corruption which was happening was truly something that was unprecedented. The more that time continued forwards, the more this moral decadence seemed to be increasing. Now, of course, as we have said in one of our previous programs, that according to the Ahlul Bayt, the people are upon the religion of their rulers. So if the rulers happen to be people who are mean or who are cruel or who have hard hearts or they are people who do not have any liking or yearning towards religion and deen and faith, well, the rest of the people will be in a similar fashion. Now, when talking about these kind of moral excellencies in order to combat the moral decadence that was prevalent during his era, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam talks about three things. And he says, these are three things that whoever has them, they will have no regret. Now, in the previous program, we talked about one of those three things, which was to avoid hastiness. Now, the second thing was to consult with others. Now, of course, it might seem like something that is quite blatant, and it might seem like it's common sense. But, dear friends, a lot of people don't even have this common sense. Of course, we are requested and we are advised by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that we should consult with others before making decisions. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean minor decisions, because we won't be able to consult with others in every single minor decision of ours. In the end, we will have to make our own decisions. But when it comes to major decisions, and even though materialistic decisions are not necessarily the ultimate decisions that we are going to be making, but of course they are a part of our everyday life. So for example, if you're going to buy a house or you're going to buy a car, then, of course, you should consult with each other, with other people. And who do you consult with? Well, you consult with people that are intellectuals, that are academics, but more so those people that are religious. Because as we have seen, a religious person will give you the point of view of religion. So when going to consult another person in this aspect that they are a representative of the religion, don't go to a normal person. Go to a scholar, and then go to a trusted scholar more so, a scholar which is a righteous scholar, a scholar who follows what they say, and they follow the tenets of Islam, and they apply what they have as knowledge into action. And so, of course, it is common sense now that after you consult with others regarding these important and large things that are decisions, excuse me, that we are to make in our life, of course, we will have more information at hand. And with more information, more knowledge, and more wisdom, of course, we will be able to make a better decision, inshallah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Text of Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ayyuha an-nur as-safi. As-salamu alayka ayyuha al-badr al-talim.
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Kaid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at Athoda Hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we open this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the Kidney Disease Center at Athota Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the United Arab Emirates this week to boost trade ties. South Korea is constructing four nuclear reactors for the UAE as President Yoon supports a return to nuclear energy.
Korea has also declared its 2050 carbon neutrality goal. To achieve this goal, we're working to rapidly restore the nuclear power system, which supplies carbon-free electricity, and boost the supply of clean energy, such as renewable energy and hydrogen energy.
President Yoon also seeks to boost weapons exports to the UAE on the heels of a $3.5 billion deal for a South Korean anti-ballistic missile system. This despite a controversial surveillance lapse in South Korea. President Yoon and the South Korean military have been under intense criticism following a recent incursion of five North Korean drones across the border. President Yoon and his wife Sunday visited a detachment of South Korean soldiers stationed in the UAE since 2011. South Korea has become a major arms exporter of fighter jets, tanks, and guided missiles, which have found prominent use in the war in Yemen. South Koreans, however, view such weapons sales with caution.
It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our exports, but it's not good if those weapons are then actually used in a war.
I know that area has had a lot of conflict and war, so I think selling weapons there will just make the situation worse.
South Korea is now the world's seventh largest arms dealer with prominent exports to Southeast Asia, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. Frank Smith, Seoul.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the Euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organized 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's a bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one-third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The largest biogas plant in Iran is under construction in the city of Mashhad. Biogas is a type of renewable fuel produced after organic waste, such as food scraps and agricultural waste, is decomposed in an oxygen-free environment, producing gases such as methane, which can be converted into electricity. Mashhad biogas plant will generate more than 22,000 megawatts of electricity per year.
At first glance, garbage is all about expenses associated with its collection, dumping and burying. By using cutting-edge technologies in biogas system, we can generate energy from waste. We will transfer the gases produced in our landfills to the biogas plant and burn them to generate electricity.
Biogas is a mixture of gases produced in landfills, primarily consisting of methane, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen sulfide. Since biogas technology will consume all these gases to produce energy, it will prevent the emission of large quantities of toxic gases like methane and CO2.
Methane is highly detrimental to the environment. Some experts say it is 200 times more contaminating than carbon dioxide, but the good news is it can be turned into electricity. So when we launch this plant next year, we'll breathe cleaner air with less methane emissions.
Every year, some 30 million visitors arrive in Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. This has made the bustling megacity the second in Iran after the capital Tehran to produce the most waste, with 2,000 tons of garbage generated every day. With biogas technology now available, more trash means more energy.
Each cubic meter of biogas with 60% methane content converts to 6.7 kilowatt hours energy. So the large amount of waste produced daily in Mashhad can be utilized efficiently to generate clean energy.
Mashhad already has a smaller biogas plant built on a landfill at the edge of the city. For now, authorities say biogas systems account for a small portion of electricity generated in the city. They're planning to turn biogas into one of the main energy sources with the aim of promoting the use of green fuels.
Now that biogas is seen as a viable source of energy that's both renewable and eco-friendly, Mashhad municipality says the emerging technology needs to dominate conventional methods of energy production. The city is now planning to build more biogas plants, which can both optimize waste management and produce clean energy. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said Syria is keen on maintaining continuous coordination with Iran, especially now amid rapid regional and international developments. He reiterated that Syria will not press ahead with talks with Turkey unless the goal was to end Turkish occupation in Syria and the support of terrorist organizations. Abdullahian said any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and the region, expressing Iran's trust in Syria's stances and decisions. The top Iranian diplomat held separate talks with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Maqdad, focusing on expanding economic and trade relations between both countries. In a joint press conference, Abdullahian touched upon Syrian-Iranian economic ties.
Our relations with Syria are at their best condition. We must exert our utmost efforts to boost economic ties to the level of our political ones. We agreed to prepare a long-term strategic cooperation document to be signed in the near future.
He indicated to Iran's role in preventing a planned Turkish military operation in northern Syria, welcoming diplomatic efforts for ending disputes between the two neighbors. Miqdad said the visit comes at a critical time amid challenges facing Syria.
The visit comes as we face challenges set by the U.S., the West, Israel, and their proxies. They don't want the Syrian people to heal. Our relations with Iran are strategic, and soon there will be steps taken that prove the depth of relations and both countries' belief in the necessity of enhancing them.
Miqdad said Syria will not forget the repeated Israeli aggressions, promising at the right time Syria will respond and inflict heavy losses on Israel in a way it will regret all its attacks. Amir Abdullahian's visit is part of a regional tour aimed at evaluating developments with Iran's allies. It's a reminder of the strong ties among member states of the resistance alliance, despite decades-long attempts to break them by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Flowers, gifts, and poems. In Iran, it is once again the time of the year to celebrate women, their progress, and their victories. Traditionally, 1 week is designated as Women's Week in Iran, which includes the birthday of Hazrat Fatimah, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, celebrated as Mother's Day.
The days of Women's Week have been named as follows. After Friday, which is of course Mother's Day, the day of women and their role in the family, Saturday is named Women and Virtue, Resisting Western Patriarchy, Sunday, Women and Self-Esteem, Leaders in Scientific Fields, Monday, Women, Creators of the Next Generation, Tuesday, Women, Buoyant, Resourceful and Wise, Wednesday, Women, Security and Social Justice, and Thursday, Women, Hopeful and Faithful.
But this year, Iranians are celebrating Women's Week, while under U.S. pressure, the Islamic Republic was removed from the United Nations Women's Commission, and as foreign-backed rioters have tried to exploit the concept of women and their freedom for their own political gains. So I asked the Vice President how women's status has changed over the past four decades.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women were given more opportunities to take on social roles. Women literacy has increased from 35% four decades ago to 95% today. More than 60% of university students and 30% of faculty members and professors are women. We have over 2,700 NGOs, mostly run by women.
An issue that was also raised by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a special meeting arranged to honor Women's Week. But most importantly, the leader pointed to the fact that solidarity is key, and the issue of hijab should not be exploited to divide women. Women who were present chanted slogans to show that they agree with the leader. And this is what's highlighted Women's Week this year.
The occasion this year is of more significance than ever before. It has become an opportunity to shed light on the fact that the recent foreign-backed riots and the exploitation of women to divide the country was a failed attempt by Iran's enemies. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UK's rogue royal, Prince Harry, has come under fire both at home and abroad after admitting he killed 25 Afghans during his military service. In his highly controversial memoir, Spare, Harry claims he killed 25 people during his two tours of occupied Afghanistan, adding he didn't think of them as people, but instead as chess pieces that had been taken off the board.
Harry served as an attack helicopter pilot between 2012 and 2013. The book alleges that all the targets were combatants. However, following furious protests from inside Afghanistan, many British establishment critics have condemned the revelation, believing that it creates a new and unnecessary security threat against his own family members.
Amid the condemnation, British Muslims feel particularly outraged.
I don't think Harry should be silenced for what he said. In fact, I think he should be encouraged to go into more detail about the ideology and the training that's being pumped into British soldiers. It's not even the first time that he's likened killing humans with playing games. In 2013, he said it was a joy to use his controller during airstrikes. He said it was like playing a PlayStation or an Xbox.
Afghans are also furious, with many, including Taliban officials, issuing demands for Harry to be put on trial for war crimes.
The consensus in Afghanistan, and amongst probably Muslim opinion all around the world, is that he was involved in a war where hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghans were killed, a nation was destroyed, millions were displaced, and therefore he is a war criminal who should be accounted for his crimes. I run a British Muslim website, and we did an online poll the other day, and it had about 5,000 votes. It was a one-day poll, and 85% of our readers and viewers said that Prince Harry was a war criminal. And that's because Muslims, you know, we consider ourselves one body. And if one part of the body hurts, the whole of the body hurts.
Many British Muslims are left questioning how they now view a royal family with Muslim blood on its hands. Robert Carter, London.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanat Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In recent years, global warming has become a major environmental problem. Many of us are always faced with news relating to the global warming, and we hear warnings about the worsening situation. As time passes, we will experience the effects of global warming on our lives. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Britain's Met Office predicts next year is forecast to be one of the hottest on record, with global average temperatures forecast to be above 1.2 degrees Celsius, above what they were before humans started to drive climate change. If correct, it will be the 10th year in a row to see global average temperatures reach at least 1 degree Celsius above what they were used to be in pre-industrial times, measured as the period 1850 to 1900. The current hottest year on record, dating back to 1850, is 2016, a year that saw an El Niño climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which pushes up global temperatures on top of global warming trends. Professor Adam Scaife, head of long-range predictions at the Met Office, said, "Without a preceding El Niño to boost global temperatures, 2023 may not be a record-breaking year, But with the background increase in global greenhouse gas emissions continuing apace, it is likely that next year will be another notable year in the series. The Met Office's Dr. Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific." Dr. Nick Dunstan added, "La Niña has a temporary cooling effect on global average temperature. For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the 3 consecutive years with La Niña state, with a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific." Dr. Dunstan said, "This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Dr. Douglas Smith, a leading Met Office expert in climate prediction, added, "The fact that global average temperatures are at or above 1 degree Celsius for a decade masks the considerable temperature variation across the world." Dr. Douglas Smith said, "Some locations, such as the Arctic, have warmed by several degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times." The Met Office is forecasting a global average temperature of between 1.08 degrees Celsius and 1.32 degrees Celsius above what it was in the second half of the 19th century. Last year, the Met Office predicted 2022's global temperature will be between 0.97 degrees Celsius and 1.21 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, with a central estimate of 1.09 degrees Celsius. Data for the year to October suggests the temperature is about 1.16 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial era. Meanwhile, the Hindustan Times has also reported on the same story. The team, coordinated by the United Kingdom's Meteorological Office, in their first five-year general outlook, said there is a 93% chance that the world will set a record for hottest year by the end of 2026. Teams of meteorologists across the globe predicted the world is creeping closer to the warming threshold international agreements are trying to prevent, with nearly a 50-50 chance that Earth will temporarily hit that temperature mark within the next 5 years. A team of 11 different forecast centres predicted for the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, recently, with human-made climate change continuing, there's a 48% chance that the globe will reach a yearly average temperature of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels of the late 1800s, at least once between now and 2026, a bright red signal in climate change negotiations and climate science. Britain's Met Office senior scientist Leon Hermanson, who coordinated the report, said, "We're going to see continued warming in line with what is expected with climate change. Those forecasts are big-picture global and regional climate predictions on a yearly and seasonal timescale based on long-term averages and state-of-the-art computer simulations. They're different than increasingly accurate weather forecasts that predict how hot or how wet a certain day will be in specific places. But even if the world hits that mark of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, the globe has already warmed about 1.1 degrees Celsius, or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since the late 1800s. That's not quite the same as the global threshold first set by international negotiators in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In 2018, a major United Nations science report predicted dramatic and dangerous effects on people and the world if warming exceeds 1.5 degrees Celsius. Several scientists said the global 1.5-degree threshold is about the world being that warm, not for 1 year, but over a 20- or 30-year time period. This is not what the report predicts. Hermansen said meteorologists can only tell if Earth hits that average mark year, maybe a decade or two, after it is actually reached there, because it is a long-term average. Climate scientist Zeke Hofstra of the tech companies Stripper and Berkeley Earth, who wasn't part of the forecast team, said the prediction makes sense given how warm the world already is, and an additional tenth of a degree Celsius, nearly two-tenths of a degree Fahrenheit, is expected because human-caused climate change in the next 5 years. And to add, the likelihood of a strong El Niño, the natural period warming of parts of the Pacific Ocean that alter world weather, which could toss another couple of tenths of a degree on top of that temporarily, and the world gets very close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The English website of Al Jazeera Network has also reported on the same story. A new United Nations report has found that the past 8 years were the 8 hottest ever recorded, indicating the world is now deep into the climate crisis. It said the internationally agreed 1.5 degrees Celsius limit for global heating is now barely within reach. The report by the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, WMO, set out how record high greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are driving sea level and ice melting to new highs and supercharging extreme weather from Pakistan to Puerto Rico. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that the global average temperature in 2022 will be about 1.15 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial average, meaning every year since 2016 has been one of the warmest years on record. For the past 2 years, the natural La Niña climate phenomena has actually kept global temperatures lower than they would otherwise have been. The inevitable switch back to El Niño conditions will see temperatures surge even higher in the future, on top of global heating.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction and analysis on the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu
alaikum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Muhammad ibn Hussein ibn Musa, mainly known as Sayyid al-Radhi, one of the most outstanding Shiite scholars of the 4th and 5th century Hijra, the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha, and the brother of Sayyid al-Murtaza. We can say he had so many books, but the most outstanding one is Nahj al-Balagha, the collection of the aphorisms, letters, and the speeches of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Khasa'is al-A'imma and Talkhis al-Bayan. We'll talk more about these books, inshallah. So let's just start with whom for the biography, Sheikh Rouhani.
No problem.
Let's just start with you about his early life. You know, so many interesting stories about Sayyid al-Razi and Sayyid al-Murtaza, who dedicated their life to the Shia legacy and offering books about the Shia world. Talk a little bit more about this family for us.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, Sayyid al-Razi rahmatullahi alayhi was among the offspring of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, because he was among Sadati Hashimiyya Ali Abi Talib.
Yes.
That's why his father was Hussein, son of Musa Alawi. Mm-hmm. He was one of the grandchildren of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam.
And he was called Sharif for
yeah,
this.
Sharif because
Sharif
of this. Radhi,
Sharif
yeah,
al-Murtada,
yeah
right.
Because this relation that he had with
yes.
the imams.
Yes.
And of course, his father was also a great man, Hussein ibn Musa Alawi.
Yes.
Who was among the Nuqaba of the Tashayyu in the history. Because in all the different, let's say, dynasties like Amawis or Abbasis and the other kind of kingdoms and caliphates, we have this position called Naqib.
Yes.
So this position belonged
yes.
to the children of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. But when it comes to his scholarly position,
yes.
It is said that not only among the Shia scholars, but also among the Sunni scholars, this Sayyid was considered as one of the great scholars. And
yes.
Of course, there was a very nice story about the Sayyid, Sayyid al-Razi, rahmatullah alayhi, and his brother, that Sheikh Mufid also was their teacher.
Yes.
And one day it said that Sheikh Mufid, rahmatullah alayhi, in his dream, he saw that Lady Zahra, sallallahu alayhi, took his two children, Hassan and Hussein, alayhi wa salam, and brought them to Sheikh Mufid to teach them Islamic teachings. Then in the morning when he woke up, he saw mother of Sayyid al-Razi and Sayyid al-Murtaza,
oh.
rahmatullahi alayhima,
okay.
that their mother brought them to Sheikh Mufid and asked him to teach
these two sons of mine.
That's right.
The teachings and the
okay.
doctrines of Islam.
Okay.
So, of course, you see that later, these Sayyid al-Razi and Sayyid al-Murtaza, rahmatullahi alayhim,
the greatest scholars
became,
of Islam,
yeah,
that's right.
the greatest scholars, the great, the outstanding kind of scholars in the history of Islam and Tashayyu. So, of course, the figure or the scholar like Sheikh Mufid had
yes.
this capability to teach these two Sayyid, I mean Sayyid al-Razi and Sayyid al-Murtada, rahmatullah alayhi, and he was
okay.
the one who trained them. So that's why I think the role of Sheikh Mufid and also these two scholars, great Sayyid, is the very significant role in the history of the Shayyo, and even we can say in the establishment of the Shayyo and school of thought in the history.
That's all right. Yeah, Sayyid al-Razi was a faqih, a mutakallim, a mufassir, we can say a poet, you know. He dedicated his life to preach Shiite Islam by compiling so many outstanding books. Nahjul Balagha is still, we can say, if you look into the libraries of the Muslims, beside the text of the Holy Quran, you can find a volume of Nahjul Balagha, you know. And this really makes it outstanding. What an honor for an author to his book. Or spirit say, of course, it is a collection, but it is named by Sayyid al-Razi. Is, we can say, neighbor to the text of the Holy Quran in every house. This makes it very much great. Talk a little bit more about the scholarly life of Sayyid al-Razi for us, Sayyid Mohsen Nawi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we look at the scholarly life of Sayyid al-Razi, he was basically the student of great Shia scholars, as well as he also learned the Sunni fiqh from the Sunni scholars.
Yes.
And he had command over both, we can say, like school of thoughts. On the other hand, he was basically he learned the Arabic grammar from one of his teachers. And this was the, we can say, like the interesting area for him, where he was a poet as well. So
yes.
he wrote the poems as well. And that was the base where, you know, when we talk about the Nahjul Balagha, basically, it is the eloquence of
yes. The peak of eloquence.
Peak of eloquence.
Yes.
So the eloquence, obviously, it is related to Balagha
yes.
and the literature. So the best Arabic,
al-Mu'minin.
We can say, like the eloquence, which
yes.
was available in the speeches of the Amir al-Mu'minin, according
yes.
to Sayyid Razi, we can say. So he gathered
yes.
Those things in his book. So he was one of the pious, we can say, the most pious personalities of his time. And about his scholarly life, one of his students once, it is said, like requested him to write the history of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam. Yes. And therefore he went towards the book Khasaisul A'imma.
Yes, this
book. You know, the Khasais, the characteristics of the A'imma, yes. The infallible imams.
Yes.
But what we see in this book is just the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
Like initially he wanted to write the life of the 12 imams, but when he started, he wrote about the life of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam and he stopped.
Yes.
And this Khasaisul A'imma made him to stop on Amirul Mu'mineen and go towards Nahjul Balagha.
Yes.
So this was, we can say, like the motivation, basically. Yes. So it motivated him when he entered into the life of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. He went towards the Nahjul Balagha and he didn't finish the book of Khasaisul A'imma, which was basically one of the books which was supposed to be written on all the A'imma, all the infallible imams. But in the book Khasaisul A'imma as well, like he talks about the characteristics of Imam Ali, his miracles, we can say extraordinary things that he had done, his knowledge, the narrations of the Prophet about the Imam Ali, the speeches of the Umar about Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and the will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So basically, he was a great scholar. On the other hand, in the governments, obviously, of his time, he had different ranks at that time. He was the judge in one of the times. And on the other hand, he was known as the chief of Sadat, Sayyids.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is known as Niqabat or Naqib. So he was the chief and he was looking after the Sayyids, the orphans, and he used to provide them the financial support. Yes. So basically he had the great position. On the other hand, you know, the waqf that we have.
Yes.
Mawqufat, he had that in his hand at that time in the Ghazaman.
Okay.
So because that was the time when Banu Abbas was weak.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it had issues in its time. And it was becoming weaker and weaker. So this was the best time for Sayyid Razi to, we can say, like to...
That's right.
To do the activities in this regard.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La
ilaha illallah.
Still nowadays, the book of Nahjul Balagha is unknown to so many Muslims, okay?
Yes.
I have myself talked to so many Muslims, especially among our Sunni brethren, and they are not familiar with this book, what is the main content of this book, and what is the use of this book. But it is really, we can say, a treasure, and pearls of wisdom are over there for those who are interested in the wordings and in the statements of a person, okay, who was not a prophet, but an infallible imam, okay, a leader of a community and the Muslim ummah, and how practical some of the sentences and the statements of Imam Ali is still for today's governors, politicians, you know, and everywhere around the world, especially when you refer to Imam Ali's letter to Malik al-Ashtar when he was sent to Egypt as the governor. It's really fascinating that the people nowadays are taking care of the rights of the governors and the politicians, and they can find it over there. That's right. Okay, and one of the most other most outstanding works is Talkhisul Bayan, you know, about the concept of metonymies and the metaphors in the Holy Quran, those words who are ambiguous that exist in the text of the Holy Quran, what are the meanings? This is great again. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, anything missed about Sayyid al-Razi and Nahjul Balagha?
Yes, one of the final points that I can mention regarding Sayyid al-Razi and Nahjul Balagha is this, that of course Nahjul Balagha is a very much great and valuable kind of Islamic sources that nowadays we have.
Yes.
But as you see, as was mentioned by our friends as well, that Sayyid al-Razi looked at the ahadith and the sermons and the sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam from the perspective of eloquence.
Mm-hmm.
He just collected those kind of speeches and narrated that was much more like poetic or let's say perfect in terms of literary perspective.
Value, yeah, that's right.
But you see that if he had collected the other kind of sermons, the other kind of speeches and ahadis and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, of course, we would have access nowadays to lots of other kind of meaningful and very rich in content, the sayings of the Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
They might have been collected by some of the scholars, but since, unfortunately, many of the works, many of the ahadis, many of the sources were actually destroyed or burned by the unfortunately the these and that kinds of kings or caliphs in the history. That's why unfortunately we do not have access to those other sayings of the Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right. As you said, Ibn Abil Hadid had a beautiful shahr on Nahjul Balagha, Qutbuddin Rawandi too. We can say Minhajul Bara'a fi Shahr Nahjul Balagha, and so many other outstanding books and collections exist over there. Sayyid Mohsen, anything missed?
Yes, we couldn't talk much about Nahjul Balagha at this point. Obviously, this is known as the brother of Quran.
Yes.
Akhul Quran, the book itself.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, we have currently a new version of Nahjul Balagha, which has been collected by one of the recent ulamas, the Kamil or Tamam Nahjul Balagha, which is the complete Nahjul Balagha.
Yes, yes.
Which means that, you know, the collections that Sayyid Razi had from the speeches, in this book, they have brought the whole speech.
Yes.
So this is also available in the market, but obviously it's in Arabic language until it's been translated. But on the other hand, we have 108, we can say, like, translations of Nahjul Balagha in different languages. And obviously the Nahjul Balagha itself is something which we must follow it, because many scholars from the Egypt, especially the ones who were the chiefs or the, we can say, like, the ones who were running the Al-Azhar University, we had this from different Sheikh Shaltut as and the other scholars as well. They said, like, when we read the Nahjul Balagha, then our tone was changed. You know, the way of delivering speech was changed, because it is the best eloquence. So it is good to...
Sorry, I was mistaken. Nahjul Sa'ada.
Nahjul Sa'ada.
Fi Mustadak Nahjul Balagha by Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi.
This is
really outstanding, because all the sentences that were missed by Sayyid al-Razi were completed by the late Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi. We produced one program on this outstanding man, Muhammad Baqir Mahmoudi, in our, we can say, previous series of the program. Nahjul Sa'ada fi Mustadak Nahjul Balagha. That's right. Okay. That's it. Thank you very much. Sayyid al-Razi passed away on Muharram 6, 406, according to the Hijra calendar. Some people say he was buried in Karkh neighborhood in Baghdad. Some people say his body was taken into Al-Kadhimiyya and was buried next to the holy shrine of Haram Al-Kadhimiyya over there. This was the life and works of Sayyid al-Razi. The author of Khasais al-A'imma, Talqis al-Bayan, and also Nahjul Balagha, the compiler of Nahjul Balagha. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call-of-islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.